Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The 2019 legislative session is entering its final days with the fate of many key bills still up in the air. Issues like raising the state minimum wage to $15 an hour, a paid family leave plan, a long-term revenue source for clean water projects, and a tax and regulate marijuana system. There are also questions if Governor Phil Scott will veto any of these bills if they pass. Well, one thing is clear from the governor's point of view. He thinks lawmakers are considering too many tax increases to finance a number of bills, and he isn't happy about this situation.
When you take everything in the aggregate, if you include paid family leave, we're talking about $125 million worth of additional taxes on Vermonters. So I'm more interested in what are we doing in the aggregate rather than individually.
What bills will make it all the way through and which ones will have to wait until next year? Today on the program, we've got a group of Vermont's best political reporters to take a look at some of these issues. With us today, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, Xander Landon of VT Digger, and VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, earlier in the session, the Senate gave its strong approval to legislation raising the state minimum wage to $15 an hour. And Senate President Tim Ash says this legislation is one of the Senate's top priorities for the year.
The status quo is that adults, tens of thousands of adults, making $10.78 an hour, they are not high school kids. Many of them have kids and are the big breadwinner in the family. And people have to ask if that's an acceptable amount of money to expect an adult to live on in Vermont in the year 2019. The answer is obviously no.
Well, that measure is now being considered in the House, where some people are concerned that the passage of the bill could result in a need to increase the budget for many health care workers in the Medicaid program. House Majority Leader Jill Krawinski says Democratic leaders are aware of this problem and are considering a smaller increase in the minimum wage.
What we are focusing on this week is finding a path forward so that we can make sure that we can give Vermonters a raise. And whether that is 15 on the mark, I don't know.
Setting up an interesting dynamic, Pete, between the House and the Senate. You've been following this issue very closely. Do we sense some friction between the House and the Senate on this issue?
I think we have some friction. I think we have some suspicion. I think we have some skepticism. But that is not entirely surprising to see. We've seen the same dynamic play out for a number of years now between the House and the Senate. To be clear, there are two big labor issues going on in Montpelier right now. One is the paid family and medical leave bill. The other is the minimum wage bill. The paid family and medical leave bill is the House's baby. The minimum wage bill is the Senate's baby. And so what we're seeing right now is the House in possession of the Senate's top priority and the Senate in possession of the House's top priority. And that means you're going to see a little gamesmanship cropping up around this. There are some concerns in the House about whether or not they have a decent vote count on a $15 minimum wage bill, $15 by 2024, which is what the Senate passed. And we're in real time right now watching the House try to figure out how it can come up with a plan that gets the requisite number of votes, not only to pass, but to have some hope of actually becoming law and either avoiding a gubernatorial veto or being able to override a veto if one happens.
April, last session, Governor Phil Scott vetoed a similar bill. What are his thoughts this year?
Well, he said at the press conference on Thursday, he's worked very hard to avoid the V word this year, which is true. He's really avoiding directly threatening to veto anything, even though, you know, he vetoed the minimum wage bill this year or last year. Excuse me. This year, he's been a lot more I'm willing to listen. We'll wait and see what comes out. And he indicated at the press conference this week that he would be willing to talk about maybe either a longer trajectory for getting to $15 an hour or a smaller increase in some way.
And Zander, as April pointed out, the governor, he seems to have this attitude this year, which is a little bit different than last year, of kind of wait and see rather than saying, no, I'm going to veto this, I'm going to veto that. Is there a change in the way that he's approaching the legislature?
Absolutely. I think it's been pretty clear since the beginning of the session. I mean, even last year, midway through, we saw him send out a list of proposed legislation that he would veto if it passed across the finish line of the legislature last year in its form, basically clearly threatening to strike down legislation that was not that in his view would raise the cost of living on Vermonters. This year, it's a much different approach. He's basically saying, you know, basically with almost all these major proposals, minimum wage and paid family leave, there are versions of these proposals that he could support. But he's also being pretty clear that a $15 by 2024 minimum wage is something that he would veto again. His chief of staff has said that, essentially. The paid leave proposal is raising concerns for him because the versions that have been proposed by the legislature would be funded through a mandatory payroll tax. He's been pretty clear that he doesn't want to see a payroll tax of any kind. He's proposed a voluntary paid leave program. So while, yes, he's not sort of openly threatening his veto pen, there are clearly some hard lines that Democrats are certainly aware of.
And on the minimum wage issue specifically, there's a growing sense that the House Appropriations Committee, which is in possession of that bill right now and trying to figure out what it's ultimately going to look like, might not pass out a bill that hits that $15 number, which has sort of become a rallying cry of the Vermont Democratic Party and a key figure in Democrats' electoral strategy. What some people are looking at right now and what there's some sense may emerge is, okay, right now we have a minimum wage that grows by the consumer price index every year. That's set in state law. What about if we double that? We say it'll go up two times the CPI in any given year with a cap so that it would never go up more than 5% in any given year. And I know that Phil Scott himself has let some legislators know that he likes that idea a whole lot more than the idea that the Senate passed. So it's just fascinating to see the way the administration is working hand in glove with some legislators in the building to kind of bring about an outcome on the minimum wage bill that he might actually be able to end up signing.
And I think that the Senate is also aware of these constraints, that not everyone in the House, not all House Democrats are on board with a $15 minimum wage by 2024, and that certainly they're aware that the governor isn't either. They've also said, bottom line, we want to see the legislature enact a wage increase this year, period, over nothing. We're not going to hold to the principle of a $15 minimum wage by 2024 just to hold to the principle of that. They're open to just getting something done this year.
Unlike last year, where it really did seem to be more about principle and politics, we should say, they passed that $15 minimum wage bill knowing full well, I think, that Phil Scott was going to veto it, knowing full well they would not have the votes to override it. This year, they seem much more interested in a compromise that will actually make something happen on the minimum wage front, even if that means they have to give up this sort of $15 number that has really come to take on a lot of symbolic significance within the Democratic Party.
In April, the connection there between the minimum wage and paid family leave, if the Democrats feel like on minimum wage, let's get something done this year. We don't want to repeat what happened last year. Does it then have an impact on the paid family leave bill?
Well, they're still adjusting the paid family leave bill in the Senate, and that's kind of a different animal in that, first of all, from the governor's perspective, he has his own idea that he's sticking to about having a voluntary paid family leave program that would allow you to have 6 weeks off at 60% of your wages, and the proposal that passed the House was more generous than that. It would allow 8 weeks off. And of course, as Zander mentioned, it would be funded by a payroll tax. And so the governor seems to still be sticking to that line that he wants this voluntary program. The paid family leave bill in the Senate has been stripped down a little bit, or quite significantly, actually. It would remove the ability for people to take leave for their own personal medical issue, and that changes the nature of the program pretty significantly, but it also lowers the tax rate that would be needed. So there's still some kind of wrangling and negotiation within the Democrats about that bill, but the governor is still pretty firmly in his camp on the voluntary side.
Today in the program, we've got a reporter's roundtable looking at the issues at the legislature in the final days or weeks of this session. Let's talk to Harry, who's calling from Rockingham. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm about a mile from the border, and I do believe we have lost a number of industries here over the past 10 years that are now over in New Hampshire. One of them, Chamberlain Machine Company, been here since World War II. They left, and the owner told me it was the steady rise of taxes from the state and the local that was forcing them to leave. And that's true. It's you're going to see a lot of jobs moving to New Hampshire, especially along the Connecticut River Valley. Another thing that I'm an independent, but it seems to me that the Democrats get in and the family leave bill. You're having owned the business here. The family leave bill, if you hire people and you have to pay that, that's a non-starter for a lot of businesses up here. And some of them won't be able to leave. They'll just have to suck it up and do it. But the most egregious, I think, is this business with the fuel tax. We already got one a few years ago, and when you notice it on there after the oil man left, your fuel bill had been raised a few dollars. And it's amazing to me that they're going to do it again, all for the sake of insulating people's homes. Well, you know what it would cost me to insulate my home? I had an audit here by the Vermont insulating company in Chester, a very fine one, and they told me at least $10,000 in labor and about another $7,000 just for materials. So it'll be about $17,000-$18,000.
Okay.
And so that is. I'd like to take my answer off the phone, but
okay.
That's something they ought to think about it,
Harry, thank you very much for your call. We are going to talk about that fuel tax and its link to perhaps to weatherization programs a little later in the program. But, Xander, this is sort of a point that Governor Phil Scott makes. He looks at the minimum wage in New Hampshire, which is $7.25. And he compares it to going up to $15 an hour in Vermont and says, this is not good.
Absolutely. There's so much concern about competitivity issues and just the burden that this would have on small businesses. That's why we're seeing, the concern in the House and in the governor's office about this legislation among Democrats and Republicans. I would say that the paid family leave bill, which the caller just mentioned, sort of having concerns about that being sort of a cost on businesses, is sort of being billed by both the governor and Democrats and as something that could actually improve business by drawing more folks and young people to the state. The argument is that if you have more businesses offering these benefits that young families like, you will bring people in. And the governor, was saying that yesterday, that he sees it as an employment and a recruitment tool as well. It's just a question over, who should be shouldering the cost and should people be shouldering the cost and businesses be shouldering the cost, even if it's something that they don't want to offer and employees don't want to pay for.
And one of the interesting things about Harry's comments, I think, is the number of different initiatives that he listed there in his 30 seconds on the phone, right? He talked about the fuel tax. He talked about paid family leave. He talked about minimum wage. He talked about regulations. And Phil Scott would say that's exactly the problem with what's going on with Democrats in the legislature right now is they're all over the board. So if you look at any one of these proposals in a vacuum, yeah, maybe there'd be a great reason to do that. But he says when you take them all together, they would serve to undermine the business climate in some pretty profound ways. That's his view. And he's really kind of encouraging Democrats to say, pick out the thing you want most. Pick out the thing you think is going to do the best for the Vermonters you're trying to help. And let's see if we can get together, executive branch and legislative branch, and do that one thing. Because he says, we're not going to be able to do everything. And if you try to do everything, you're going to force my hand in a way that maybe makes it so we don't do anything.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John, who is calling from Stratford. Hey, John, welcome to the program. Oh, I think we just lost John. So let's go to Joseph in St. Johnsbury. Hi, Joseph.
Yes, hi. Hi there. I was just thinking that I'm on welfare myself, and the access to being able to save money and things like that are very prohibitive to get a job. A $100 car 20 years ago is a $2,000 car today. It's very prohibitive when you're on disability or welfare. You're not really allowed to save any money to, you know, buy a vehicle or pay for possible fuel bills and things. And I've had friends that worked at some of the fast food type restaurants, and they would just have to come in twice as much and work less hours in order for the business to not have to pay them larger wage and disability income, taxes and things like that. So it always, manure runs downhill, unfortunately.
Joseph, thanks for your phone call. Today in the program, we've got a reporter's roundtable looking at minimum wage, paid family leave, some other issues at the State House. With us today, Xander Landon of VT Digger, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. We've been talking about the minimum wage bill and also paid family leave. And we want to look at how the Senate has scaled back this paid family leave bill, which is a real priority for members of the House. And essentially, it has a smaller benefit package, and it does not include a House provision for personal medical leave time. Here's Senate Economic Development Chairman Michael Sorotkin.
We have to draw the line in terms of costs, in terms of what we're going to start with. The big driver of the cost was the care for oneself when they get sick on the job. It costs a minimum wage employee under our version 1 cent an hour to have this benefit. And it costs the average worker in Vermont, who makes $50,000, $1 a week.
But Ashley Moore, who represents a business group that supports the House plan, says the Senate bill simply doesn't go far enough.
Personal medical leave is a fundamental piece of any paid family and medical leave insurance program.
So, April, help us understand, what's the Senate's thinking here? Are they thinking that they need to have a smaller tax increase, a smaller payroll tax increase to support this program?
Yeah, as far as I understand it, that was one of the main concerns, is about the tax rate. So the way that the Senate Economic Development Committee crafted it, and we should know it's still in committee. It's in the Senate Finance Committee, I believe, right now. So it's still being worked on. But the way that Senate Economic Development drafted it, it would be a 0.2% payroll tax, which is, I think, about half of what it had been in the previous version of the bill.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Matt, who is calling from Windsor. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going today?
Great.
Hey, I got a question about the Paid Family Leave Act. Hey, I live in Vermont and work in New Hampshire. How is this going to affect me? Is there any benefit for me?
Matt, you would ask that, wouldn't you? Here's my understanding, that the it is the Vermont. I think that you would not, if you are a wage earner in New Hampshire, then you would not be taxed as part of this program. I'm not positive about that, but that's my understanding.
Matt, that's a great question. We're going to have to look into that. Let's talk to Peter, who is calling from Brattleboro. Hey, Peter, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I just wanted to chime in pretty much what a previous caller was talking about. My fear is I'm on a fixed income, and there are a lot of people out there who are. And if the minimum wage goes up to $15, there are a number of companies out there are going to say, they could afford this at $7. Let's put it up to, it was at, we were selling something at $7. Let's put it up to 12 or 15. And so I think there would be a real risk of inflation, and it would hurt people on a fixed income. On the other hand, I was living overseas when I went to school. And in France, they had a president at the time was President Pompidou, and they had a price freeze, which I think lasted about a year or 2 years. I don't know if that was effective or not, but they might consider something like that if that was possible to actually do.
Okay, Peter, we appreciate your phone call very much. Xander, sort of lost in all of this is the governor's plan, which was voluntary. It was going to be a plan with New Hampshire. The last time I checked in New Hampshire, it was not doing very well over there in the New Hampshire legislature. But is there any talk of trying to start with a voluntary plan and then if it doesn't work or other circumstances occur, moving to more of a mandatory approach?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I read news yesterday from New Hampshire that the governor vetoed the legislature's paid leave program, which is somewhat similar to the one that's on the table in Vermont. Clearly, they did not adopt the plan, which was a joint plan with both governors, Governor Sununu of New Hampshire, Governor Scott of Vermont, to actually basically leverage both state workers, population of both of the state's workers to make the pool of employees in the program large enough so that it would become somewhat affordable for, you know, the businesses here to offer this to their employees. I think that Democrats have been very resistant from the beginning to that proposal. There is a concern that if you make the program voluntary, if you make it something that not everyone has to pay into, it will drive the cost up. The governor is pretty insistent that that's not the case, but there's been skepticism from Democrats that you need to have a universal participation in a paid leave program to make it something affordable and that in general the benefit should be something that anyone can access. That's the way that they prefer to see a paid leave program. So there's never been any real pickup or take up of the idea of a voluntary program from Democrats. That could change in the next week. You never know. But it's been something that they've been very resistant to.
And there's been some suggestion from Republicans maybe we can thread this needle with something like an opt-out provision, right? We have created a paid family leave program. Everybody's in. But if you don't want to be in it, then you can notify the state in some way and you would no longer be in the program. The payroll tax would not be assessed on your wages. That has not been a concept that Democrats in the Senate, at least so far, have seemed terribly amenable to. But it is one concept that some people think, you know, could offer some hope of a compromise.
April, we've been talking about the connection here, perhaps between the paid family leave bill and raising the state minimum wage. Do you think it's a situation here where they either both make it or they both don't?
I don't know. I don't know how to predict that. I think Democrats want both. I don't think they want it to be a trade-off between the two. And, you know, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, the Senate and the House each have one that they love. So I think that they're still going to go full bore for both.
I think that there's going to be some serious negotiating, though, in the next week because the proposal that the Senate is looking at now, which is a scaled back version of the House proposal that doesn't offer personal medical leave and offers fewer weeks of compensated leave time, is something that I don't think House leadership is particularly fond of. They want to see a more generous program. So there's going to be some negotiating in the next week between, I think, all three bodies or all three, the House, the Senate and the governor. There's going to be some changes made.
Well, another bill at the State House where the future is somewhat uncertain is the Tax and Regulate Marijuana Bill. The Senate earlier this year gave its approval to legislation that would have the state regulate marijuana much in the same way that it regulates alcohol. There'd be a state commission, there'd be retail stores licensed by the state would oversee quality control. Now, the governor is insisting that the bill also includes some way of testing driver impairment in a roadside test. And Scott says using a saliva test might satisfy his concerns. But there is a problem with this. The saliva test measures only the presence of marijuana, not the impairment level. And this has prompted both House Judiciary Chairwoman Maxine Grad and Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Sears to question the use of the saliva test.
Right now it looks like it has not been scientifically proven as effective. To start using roadside saliva testing now, I'm not comfortable with that.
And I don't know why people have gotten so hung up on the saliva test when the test is basically meaningless. So I would agree totally with that.
So, April, another issue in this is whether or not there needs to be a warrant before the saliva test is administered. How do you see this shaking out?
Well, what they've done is, at least my understanding, the latest version of the bill is that they've said that you can start using the saliva test when there's one that's kind of generally accepted as accurate and useful. So there'd be kind of like a trigger provision in the bill to allow that to go forward. So that would kind of give it some, maybe alleviate some of those concerns about the scientific usefulness of that kind of test. The warrant piece is interesting. The governor's not sure, at least last I heard, he wasn't sure what he felt about the warrant piece. His public safety commissioner, Tom Anderson, was pretty clearly against including a warrant requirement. He said that if they had a warrant requirement, he's not even sure that this would be a helpful thing, a helpful tool, because they can already use a blood test, and that requires a warrant. So what Tom Anderson wants to do is kind of leave the warrant question up to the courts and let that be worked out later.
And Pete, is this one of those issues where we're talking about a lot of questions about it and time just might run out here?
Yeah, there's very little of that time left, and I don't think there's a perception that there's really a fire in the belly right now in House lawmakers to do the considerable amount of work they would have to in order to get this thing across the legislative finish line. So, you know, you talk to folks that are following this issue closely in the state house right now, and you do not get a sense of enormous optimism that this is something that's going to make it across the legislative finish line in 2019, at least.
And Zander, the governor has been saying, well, what's the rush? Let's see how other states deal with this issue. If we have to wait until next year, no problem.
Yeah, certainly from the governor's office, he sees no rush here. And he would say that he's been clear since the beginning that he'd be willing to support this if it had the two pieces that he wants to see in the bill, which is one, as we've said already, the roadside safety piece, which is as we've discussed, basically is the roadside saliva test and possibly some funding, also additional funding for drug recognition experts. That's something that a lot of Democrats would like to see, just instead of a saliva test, just spend a lot of money on new DREs, forget the testing. That's enough in some Democrats' view. But for the governor, it's not. And the other thing is just some amount of new spending on education prevention efforts for basically youth. Whether he doesn't really have a preference for how it's spent, but some amount of money going into prevention so that there aren't children using cannabis. So as long as those two things are clearly in the legislation, there are a couple of other pieces of contention. The biggest one is he's actually flagged a constitutional concern in the bill, which has not been addressed by the legislature. His concern is that he wants to see more he wants to be able to appoint more of the members of the regulatory board that would oversee dispensaries. Right now, that's a 5-member board. He'd only be appointing one member, and that in and of itself could be enough for the governor to not support this bill. So there are a lot of reasons why he may not vote this bill when it gets to him, if it gets to him this year. But as you've suggested, there are other concerns and other problems that are being addressed in the House right now. They're debating the tax rate, whether 16% for sales is enough. Some people want to see it higher, more like 20%, which is what Massachusetts has done. There's a lot to iron out here.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Charlie, who's calling from Northfield. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thanks. To your previous discussion, everybody's talking about spending, and they're not talking about revenue generation. I feel strongly Vermont has created the largest gated community in the nation with the regulations that are not business-friendly. I think your problem to accomplish your minimum wage and your spending is to bring in more revenue.
Okay, Charlie. Pete, I would think that Governor Phil Scott would agree with that, that if there was a way to bring more workers into the state of Vermont, generate more tax revenue, then that would be a way to pay for programs.
That's been his stock line since he was first elected. We don't need higher taxes in Vermont. We need more people paying them. He's got a number of initiatives underway to try to rectify some of the demographic trends in Vermont that are frightening to, I think, just about anybody who has looked at them. But, you know, nobody's really found that magic bullet that makes more people, young people in particular, want to come live in Vermont.
Today, we've got our reporters' roundtable looking at some of the outstanding issues at the State House. With us today, VPR's Pete Hirschfeld, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and Xander Landon of VT Digger. Let's take a look at this whole water quality issue. The House today gave its final approval to legislation that's designed to help clean up Lake Champlain and other lakes and streams all across the state. The legislation creates a new regionalized distribution system for the delivery of special grants. It also includes roughly $25 million in state money to be spent each year in the next 20 years. It uses the state's capital bill, the property transfer tax, the uncollected bottle redemption fund, and it takes 4% of the overall revenue from the rooms and meals tax. Now, it backfills the loss of that rooms and meals revenue by eliminating the current exemption on software programs that are downloaded from the cloud. Ways and Means Chairperson Janet Ansel noted that the state already taxes hard copies of computer software and that this extension merely reflects how a lot of software is now being delivered.
We feel that this is the time to move to actually tax that pre-written software, no matter how it's delivered. There are 17 states and D.C. All have moved in this direction, so we're not the first.
Governor Phil Scott says he'll take a look at the proposal, but he is very concerned about adding a new tax.
We went in again with the budget. We had some changes within the tax code to derive about what I think is now about $25 to $30 million, something of that nature. What they're proposing is over and above all of that. They've used all the tax capacity that we built in and added to it.
Pete, you did a big story this week on this issue. What are opponents of the cloud tax saying about it?
They're saying a few different things. Number one, they're saying you assess a sales tax on this product and you are functionally increasing the price of that product. Either the price of the product for us to make or the price that our customers are going to have to pay, because somebody is going to have to absorb that 6% sales tax surcharge that's now going to be put on there. And they're saying anytime you raise prices, raise operating expenses, gross or net, you are having a drag on the industry that has to deal with those new costs. But their biggest point, I think, is that this is a policy decision that sends precisely the wrong message to an industry on which the future of Vermont's economy in many ways is going to hinge, right? Vermont is a place that really wants to style itself as a remote working destination, a place for tech startups. We don't have a lot of manufacturing industry here. We don't have a huge amount of infrastructure that can support the manufacturing base. What we do have is a lifestyle and a landscape that a lot of smart entrepreneurial people might want to be surrounded by to start the next dealer.com or the next MyWeb grocer. And they say, if we want to create the best environment, the environment that is going to be likeliest to produce great tech companies that are offering lots of high-paying jobs, then we don't want to have a tax policy that suggests to them we want to in any way impede what they're trying to do. So really it's more about the sentiment that this sends than the $6 million a year that it would ultimately raise.
I was actually surprised yesterday at the support that this proposed tax got. There was 124 folks voting for, maybe 14 voting against. The Republican minority leader said that she didn't really view this as a new tax. She viewed it as a modernization of our tax code. You know, you used to go out and buy physical copies of software. You'd pay a sales tax on that. And now we see, you know, more and more software being accessed and downloaded over the internet. And, you know, that's how this was pitched. As the chair of Ways and Means said on this program or the recording of her speaking, a lot of other states, about 20 other states, are doing this. So I was, you know, somewhat surprised to see that there was so much consensus about that from at least the legislature. The governor has indicated some concern about it, though.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Matt, who is calling from Barrie. Hi, Matt. What's on your mind today?
So I may have read it wrong, but it appeared that they were going to take money out of the education fund as part of this lake cleanup. And every time they do something like that, it's very infuriating as a taxpayer because of the effects it has has on us with our property taxes and the cost of living here. Since January 1st, I can think of three municipalities that dump raw sewage into the watershed with no penalty, no fee, nothing like a business would have if they did that. And they turn around and want the rest of us to help pay for this lake cleanup when and they're giving the farmers a hard time, and the farmers have come a long way in their practices to make sure that they're making the environment clean and keeping the lake clean. So it's quite frustrating to see how these people operate. And they're not there to generate revenue. They're there to pay for services that the state has to provide. They're not revenue generators. They're not businesses.
Okay, Matt, we appreciate your phone call very much. April, it's sort of an interesting situation, if I understand this bill correctly. It's taking 4% of the overall revenue from the rooms and meals tax. Now, that money, as Matt suggested, currently goes into the education fund. So it's taking that money out, and that leaves a hole. And to fill that hole, it's going with the cloud tax.
Yeah, that's basically it. And part of what they're trying to do here is any money that they're using to pay for water quality efforts, they want to have some type of, you know, plausible connection to water. So that we have the property transfer tax. You can argue that there's a connection there with runoff from properties. The rooms and meals tax connection. The idea is that, you know, the lake and our water quality is very important to tourism, and it draws people here. And I think it's easy to take money from that. But so instead of, so they're siphoning some of that off from the Ed Fund, as the caller mentioned, and they are backfilling it with this this new cloud tax, which would raise about $6 million in this coming year, as well as expanding the sales tax for online purchases to include, for example, like when Amazon facilitates a transaction for a third party. Like if you're buying something on Amazon, but it's not from Amazon, currently that is exempt from the sales tax, or it's not fully clear. And so this would apply the sales tax to those kind of transactions. And all of that sales tax money, 100% of it goes into the education fund. So the argument is that it more than makes up for what's being lost, but it's right that, they're taking money away from the Ed Fund that otherwise would help to support schools and relieve pressure on property taxpayers.
Pete, as Zander mentioned, this bill passed easily in the House both yesterday and today in roll call votes, something to 120 to 14, something in that neighborhood. I mean, it was huge in favor of this bill. What's its outlook in the Senate? Do we have any idea?
We're beginning to get an idea. And, you know, it's funny. This is not the first time the legislature has had a debate over what's called the cloud tax, familiarly. And back when they wanted to put this in place in 2010, the House was very supportive of it. The Senate was a little more skeptical. And we have a similar dynamic playing out right now. A lot of the same people are in place that were for that back then. I talked to Chittenden County Progressive Senator Chris Pearson today. He's really worried about the message that this sends to the tech industry. He's worried about the practical impact on the cost of goods and the services that they're selling. So, Senate Finance Chairwoman Ann Cummings said they'll give it an honest look. They're eager to look at what precisely the House has done. But this is not something that has any certainty of getting a thumbs up from the Senate by any means.
And Zander, right at the beginning of the program, we had a caller who talked about a number of taxes. One of them was the home heating oil tax for the weatherization program that the House passed and the Senate is taking a look at. I got the impression from the Senate leaders that, yes, they like the idea of more money for weatherization, but no, they're not very happy about the home heating tax.
Yeah, that proposal was basically an increase of 2 cents on heating fuel that the House passed a couple of months ago. That had been sort of flagged as a pretty unpopular proposal among the Senate. The Senator Tim Ash came out and said after that passed that he viewed it as a regressive tax, as the governor has also said he views it as a regressive tax, a tax that will disproportionately burden the people it aims to help, low-income residents who will have to pay more on heating fuel. But the argument from Democrats is that you're going to be raising more money, about $4.6 million, that will be used to help low-income residents weatherize or insulate their homes and therefore save on heating costs. And also, it's an environmental protection. So the Senate is committed and interested in finding new ways of raising revenue to fund additional home weatherization, but they are not going to – I don't think we're going to see them advance the House proposal. I'm not exactly sure what they're going to put forward, but I'm almost certain it will not be that.
And Pete, this week we saw the legislature deal with the issue of abortion, both in terms of legislation and a constitutional amendment, which now will go through that process and will come up again in the next elected legislature, would be 2021. You talked to the governor about the abortion bill. What can you tell us?
So to be clear, like you said, there are two separate tracks here. There's the constitutional amendment, and then there is a state piece of legislation that would become state law if it's passed this year that would say, as a matter of fact, there are no restrictions on a woman's right to get an abortion in Vermont. The legislation just got final approval in the House today, which means it is going to be on its way to the governor's desk very shortly, if it isn't already. And he has a big decision to make. And I think a lot of us that have been listening to Phil Scott talk about this bill over the past few weeks and months have gotten a sense that he would be inclined to sign it. When I talked to him today, he said he does not know what he's going to do. And I tried to draw him out to get a sense for are there technical concerns? Is it legal concerns? Or is this sort of a question of conscience for you that you're going to have to come to? And I think it's the latter. He says he respects and wants to protect a woman's right to choose, but he says this is an extraordinarily emotional issue for a lot of people. He says this is a bill that goes pretty far on that front, and that he has a tough decision in the days ahead as to whether or not he's going to allow it to become law. So we'll see.
April, another bill that got some approval this week deals with plastic bags.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to make it to the finish line?
I think so. I mean, it had a pretty strong vote in support, not just plastic bags, but also banning styrofoam takeout containers and other food and beverage containers. And that seems to have a pretty strong support. And that's also led and kind of undergirded by this grassroots support. A lot of young people have been very active on this issue and have been lobbying their local select boards. And, there's been some local referendums on this as well. And it seems like there's momentum behind it.
And Zander, we're almost out of time, but there was a bill that called for a 24-hour waiting period before someone could purchase a firearm. What's the outlook for that?
You know, it's sort of unclear at this point because the House Judiciary Committee has had that bill for a series of weeks now, I believe, and they have not taken it up and not voted it out yet. They've discussed it. They've committed to, I believe, voting it out of committee by the end of the session, but it is coming down to the wire here. So at this point, I would say we're not 100% certain that that's going to make it across the finish line this year. Had a lot of support in the Senate, and there's pressure to do something this year. But at this point, it's still in committee.
We've got about 30 seconds, Pete. When you look at the outstanding issues, be it paid family leave, minimum wage, clean water, do you think we're going to see an omnibus bill at the end that addresses all of these, or will they be taken individually?
I think they'll be taken individually. I'm struggling to imagine a scenario where you would find a way to link paid leave and clean water, for instance. So I think they'll take them one by one, and we'll be, they're going to have to move quickly. Not much time left.
It's going to be fascinating to see how these issues are resolved in the next week or two. Many thanks to our panel, April McCollum, Zander Landon, and Pete Hirschfeld. Thanks very much for being on the program today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.